Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us. What a packed program we have today. First up, joining us in studio, actually sitting right across from me right now, is Stephen Sodergren, who is the Associate Professor of History at Norwich University. And, of course, the topic will be Britain's decision to leave the EU. At 9:30, Lasha Chaturidze, who is a associate professor, again at Norwich College, director of the graduate programs in diplomacy and international relations. We'll check in with our friends at Talk Media News. Frank Chaffee will join us in the second hour. He's president of the Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation, and we're going to be talking about the F-35s, the controversy that surrounds the F-35s. And the F-35s, of course, are coming to the National Guard, but there is some controversy with those jets coming. And then we'll wrap up today's program with Nora Jacobson, filmmaker and winner of the 2016 Herb Lockwood Prize for her documentary. We'll talk about her prize and her art. Today's poll question is, did the American media do a good job informing you about the ramifications of the Brexit prior to the vote? Be interested in your opinions. If you wish to vote, please go on to our WDEV Facebook page and vote this morning. But it's my pleasure to have in our studio Stephen Sodergren, Associate Professor of History at Norwich University. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
A lot of questions I have about the UK, its vote, and its ramifications. But let's start by going back to post-World War II and Europe's efforts to sort of unite. Let's start there and come forward to what happened at the vote.
Okay. Post-World War II Europe, not exactly the most coalition-building exercise in the world. But just to start off, there are really two considerations here. There's Europe and there's Great Britain. These aren't exactly Europe has always kind of had this perhaps centralizing tendency, but the UK has always regarded itself as exceptional, apart, and with some validity to it. The empire certainly made it that way. And after World War II, there was this sense of there was the UN experiment. There's eventually North Atlantic Treaty Organization, et cetera, are all pushing towards some sort of uniting tendency, a centralizing tendency. What we now call the EU really had its origins in 1952 with the European Steel and Coal Company. This was basically a France-West Germany alliance, economic alliance, along with the Benelux countries, designed to create a system to facilitate energy exchanges, energy control in Western Europe. The success of that gives breed to what becomes the EEC, the European Economic Community in 1957 with the Treaty of Rome. And that's where six member states sign and formally create what we now know as the European Union. It just grows from there.
One of the things that you notice, though, in the 70s, you still had to show your passport as you went from country to country. Custom officers would come onto a train, for example, if you're doing that. Mm-hmm. When did this sort of all end and it was sort of all in together?
92, really. The end of the Cold War. A lot of those restrictions, there was hesitancy to lift them given the tensions of the Cold War, particularly in the 70s. But yes, as any traveler to Europe knows today, if you go to a EU country, there is the EU passport lane at customs and everybody else, and as Americans, we're everybody else. So what really begins to happen in 92 is a formal acceptance that the Treaty of Maastricht in Netherlands is basically the solidification of the common market, looking forward after the Cold War and saying, hey, we can do this. We can create the Eurozone. 92 formally creates the Eurozone. And also we can establish free immigration. We can eliminate those border crossings. My father, who served in the Air Force during the Cold War, when he travels to Europe today, he thinks it's remarkable that you can cross from France into Germany without a border, without a passport. You know, it's insane to know that. This is somebody who had, you know, who once drove through East Germany to get to Berlin, where, you know, you're being watched the entire way. It's a remarkable, a different world. And the realization in 92 was that the end of the Cold War had really set this up, that this could be a reality.
Britain at the time was sort of the odd person out as all of this was coming together back in the 50s. And it was it 1973 when they first voted to start moving towards that?
Well, the British history with the EEC, subsequently the EU, is long and storied. And, you know, let's not quite write it into the ground quite yet. But it's 57. The EEC is formally created. Britain is not interested. It's still got its empire. It's still doing okay. But also it's created its own economic system in the Commonwealth of Nations. So it doesn't really need the EEC. By 61, they're rethinking that. Their trade with Western Europe's growing. And in 61, they formally apply to become members of the EEC. And they are rejected. That's often lost in this. Throughout much of the 1960s, the UK wants in, but they keep getting vetoed by one Charles de Gaulle, president of France. The French are not happy. They don't want. They're worried that the UK is dominated by the United States, and so if they let in the UK, the EU will be dominated by the United States. So de Gaulle vetoes them in 63, vetoes them in 68. And it's only after de Gaulle loses power in 69 that the British once again try again in 71. They formally apply. They're accepted. January 1st, 1973 is the date when the British become part of the EEC EU.
Was there a vote in 73?
There wasn't a formal vote. Well, Parliament voted. This was a treaty that they had to approve. And in 1972, Parliament passes the European Communities Act, and this is important for what's going to happen now moving forward, because the European Communities Act is a remarkable document, remarkable partly because it's about a page and a half, but it's incredibly important because it's effectively saying that the UK accepts the European Parliament's jurisdiction over economic regulation. So, you know, the Eurosceptics, as they're called, point to this document as kind of the beginning of the end of the UK, because they say, well, this is when we formally signed over our sovereignty to a foreign power. Well, that's not exactly true. But in some respects, they are saying that no matter what laws Parliament passes, they have to follow the regulations passed by the European Parliament. So in many respects, economic decisions are being made outside the UK. And so that's the tension. This document, when this document is repealed, if and when, moving forward from Brexit, that's when the British are officially done with the EU, because that's when they say European Parliament rules no longer hold power in our government.
But yet Britain and the UK still maintain the pound, whereas the rest of Europe is the euro. How did that happen?
Once again, back to 92, the British, I was talking to you about this earlier. I was both surprised and not surprised by the vote. The British have always kind of had their foot out the door of the European Economic Community, out of the EU. They were divided when they went in, and they've always kind of had, you know, we talk about the special relationship between the United States and the UK. They've always had kind of a special relationship with the EU because they see themselves as special. They kind of want to be – they want the benefits of the EU and not necessarily the ramifications of what that means. So once again, the Treaty of Maastricht in 1992 stipulated that John Major, then prime minister, got a guarantee that they'd be able to preserve the pound sterling outside of the Eurozone. And this was partly because in 92, the pound was doing okay. There is a certain level of British exceptionalism to it, but in the 1970s, the British were like, well, okay, maybe we can get rid of the pound since mostly it's American dollars that are propping it up. But by the 90s, it's doing okay until the end of 92, that is. But so there's always been a sense that, you know, the pound is one of the strongest the second strongest currency in Europe. The Deutschmark at the time was much stronger. But so they managed to secure – and this was John Major trying to basically mollify both sides. It's like, well, we're still going to be part of the EU, but we'll still be able to retain our own sovereignty when it comes to currency. And in the process of trying to mollify both sides, he angered both sides. Neither the Euroskeptics or the pro-EU people were satisfied with that outcome.
Isn't that a history, though, if you look – by the way, if you look back, these are conservative prime ministers, whether it's Cameron, you know, mm-hmm. Major, going back mm-hmm. to, you know, the time when they came into the European Union. Isn't that a theme here that they're trying to walk a fine line in terms of what they're trying to do?
Yes, very much so. You have reasons, both the Conservative and Labor parties, to not like this, and you have reasons on both sides to like it. The Conservatives always see themselves as small state but pro-economy. Well, those two don't always go hand in hand. Labor always sees themselves sort of the friend of the unions, friend of friend of kind of economic liberalism, and well, at the same time, you know, further integration into the EU leads to sovereignty. What's kind of lost in all this isn't really a partisan issue. You can't point to Labor and say, oh, they're pro or against. You can't point to Conservatives and say they're pro or against. And you're seeing this with the fallout. David Cameron, a lot of Conservatives, in fact, kind of the far right wing of Conservatives, is what emerged in the UK Independence Party here that kind of drove a lot of the Brexit campaign. That's the right wing, and yet David Cameron, Conservative PM, very much in favor of it, kind of staked his reputation, too bad for him, on keeping the British in, whereas Jeremy Corbyn on the Labour side, you know, he's getting a lot of flack for having been kind of supportive of keeping the UK in, but not supportive enough. So they both tried to, you know, Jeremy Corbyn kind of tried to walk a fine line, and it's his equivocation is starting to pay back on him here. But yeah, neither party really has a dominance over this debate.
So what happens now politically in the UK? Let's start with Prime Minister, because as of October, we will need a new prime minister.
We'll need a new prime minister.
So what is the process here? Because the government isn't collapsing. It's the prime minister that's resigning.
Yes, the prime minister is resigning, but they're not – they had – it was either last year or the year before they had a general election. So British general elections are sporadic. They're not as regular as they are here in the United States. So it's basically whenever Parliament decides to have one. There's a certain regularity to it, but Cameron felt like he could stake – like I said, he staked his reputation on this, and what Parliament can do pretty much any time is have a vote of no confidence in a prime minister, and he felt that he would probably be facing this from his own party for having staked the reputation of the party on keeping the British in and failing to do that. So he fell on his sword, and he's going to fall. So basically the Conservative Party, since they still have a majority of seats in Parliament – have to find a new prime minister.
And some of the leading proponents of exiting, for example, Boris Johnson, mm-hmm. is not in Parliament, so he's not in line to be PM, is he?
Well, Boris Johnson exerts tremendous influence, but
and just for the listening audience, he's the former mayor of London, actually was born in the United States.
Yeah, but he's a very flamboyant, interesting person. You either love him a lot or you hate him a lot. He got a lot of press back in 2012 when the London Olympics occurred, and he's become one of the kind of the biggest spokesmen for Brexit. He's kind of become the face of it, and what a face it is. He's not really in line for party. He's got a future in British politics, absolutely, but he's not in line to become PM anytime soon. The Conservatives are going to have to go with it. I can't really speculate on – I've been trying to figure it out myself, and I see so much speculation. The Conservatives are going through a bit of a tumult right now as they try to pick out the future of their party, and Labor smells blood in the water. So, but Labor's facing its own internal discord. So really the political future of the UK is up in the air on so many levels.
We're talking to Stephen Sodergren, who is Associate Professor of History at Norwich University. One of the things that fascinated me is the split in the UK. I mean, the first results I saw was Gibraltar, which was 21,000 to 800. But you saw the fact that Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to stay in the European Union, and Britain or England and Wales voted to get out, and because England is, you know, where the majority of the votes are, that's what really made the difference. Is this problematic for the UK?
Yes, very much so. You know, Cameron has a tendency to stake his reputation on things. In 2014, he staked his reputation on the Scottish referendum, which came back in his favor. 55 to 45 of Scottish citizens voted to stay in the UK. Now, that should have tabled the issue, but a lot of those people were voting because of the perceived benefits they were getting from the EU. Belief that, well, we're part of the UK, and being part of the UK gets us increased membership, increased seats in the European Parliament. This is good for us. The EU is good for us. And so, yeah, a lot of people in Scotland, the Scottish Parliament, is now kind of crying foul and saying that, hey, this is, you know, this wasn't the deal. we kind of been sold a bill of goods. And so now the Scottish Parliament is investigating maybe not independence, because there's debate of whether they can have another referendum so soon. But the UK kind of wants to stay in the EU and stay in the UK. Can you do that is the thing. Northern Ireland's facing a similar thing. Gibraltar is fascinating because Gibraltar wants to do the same thing. Gibraltar of, you know, 35,000 people or something like that. Speaking of smelling blood in the water, Spain has been agitating to get Gibraltar back. Gibraltar has been a British overseas possession since 1713, 300 plus years. And Gibraltar does not want to go back to Spain, and the British don't want to give it back to Spain. But if Gibraltar has to choose between the EU and the UK, oy.
how do you get out of the EU?
It's not easy. You know, once again, what I think has not been conveyed so well in the media has been that, you know, the British are still in the EU. Last Thursday has no legal bearing on anything. It was a referendum. It was kind of a formal poll of the British people that the Conservative government said they would abide by. So at this point, nothing has changed, but it's a process, and it's a lengthy process. So if they want to get out, they would have to put – the button to push is Article 50 of the Treaty of Lisbon, and – that would mean they basically begin negotiations to withdraw, and that would set a 2-year clock. When they push the button on Article 50, they have 2 years to negotiate their exit. They have not pushed that button. They have not called in Article 50. Cameron has said that they will probably do that in October when he resigns, but there is no time. There's people agitating to speed it up, to slow it down. There's no clear date line for how this is going to happen, but it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be a long, lengthy process.
World War II showed us that a divided Europe can be a dangerous Europe. Are we headed into a dangerous time?
I don't want to say that World War II was a danger with levels of fascism and ethnic conflict, that I don't see it spiraling into that control. But certainly we're entering a new political ramification. The EU has been under such strain in the past decade, whether it's from austerity, whether it's from immigration, whether it's from terrorism. And I think the UK vote reflects all of that and more. Are we seeing the end of the European Union? No, I don't think so. But it's going to have to grow and change if it's going to remain a viable institution. And I don't think that Europe's headed for a new cataclysm or anything like that. But the future is uncertain.
Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, Mike, yeah, this is a question I'd asked last week. Was actually using an imperfect analogy of the early years after the American Revolution. We started off with a confederated type governance structure as a central governance structure here in the new country, and then turned over after a while into what we now have as the more powerful centralized federal government structure. And I'm wondering, and especially this, I get curious with Ray hearing all the buyer's remorse that is cropping up really quickly, it seems, over in the UK. But are we seeing the possibility that the EU will come out actually out of this as a more powerful centralized structure as opposed to being weakened by all of this? And will the UK actually leave?
Stephen?
that's an excellent comparison, actually, because when sort of democratic organizations are put under strain, any sort of democratic organizations, they have to make this choice of, do we want more regulation or less regulation? Do we want more centralization or less? The EU has for the past 50 plus years has been moving towards more centralization, more control, more power in the European Parliament, more power in the European Council. And what's interesting is that at the same time, as that power increases, voter turnout in European parliamentary elections has been plummeting down to about 40% in, I think, the 2014 election cycle. So it seems like it's gaining more power, and yet more and more people are less involved in the process. Do we need to have like a 1787 constitutional convention for the EU to kind of to fix this whole thing and to correct the errors of it? I'm not so sure about that. But centralization is exactly why UK is leaving. They don't want to hand over their sovereignty to a supranational organization, which was founded on the basis of what's called combined sovereignty, which, you know, there's a lot of people who don't like the idea of decisions being made outside of their country. And that's been the case with Britain from the very beginning, is the Eurosceptics, as they've been called, have been hesitant to do this. And they've always had a voice, but this is the first time that voice seems to have really kind of picked up, quote, you know, a majority or something like that. A lot of that has to do with the pressures of immigration, terrorism, the economy, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, will Britain actually leave? I don't know. I thought they were going to. I called the Brexit vote wrong, so I'm not going to speculate.
You and a lot of other people.
I'm a historian. I look backward.
I'm gonna ask Lasha this question as well. Does the European Union work with so many countries having different histories, and as a result having different histories, have nationalistic pride that's different than another country?
Yes. I mean, that's the problem. And that's, you know, the reason why the American Constitution kind of worked is that, yes, all the colonies were different, but they weren't that different. They had all been kind of founded by the same country. Europe, you go back hundreds, thousands of years, and they have ethnic and national loyalties crisscrossed all over the place. And the very fact that EU exists, I think, is a tremendous indication that Europe can work together. But that system is now under stress. And will it be able to withstand that stress is the greater question. This might be the beginning of something huge, to paraphrase Churchill. This might not be the beginning of the end. It might be the end of the beginning. But at the same time, in 1988, Margaret Thatcher gave a speech in Bruges about the EU, where she basically said what makes Europe great is that France is France, Spain is Spain, and Britain is Britain. We shouldn't stop being ourselves by being part of the EU. And that's a delicate balancing act. How do you maintain national identity and national sovereignty in a parliamentary European organization? It's a good question. They've been struggling with it for decades.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stephen Sodergren. Really appreciate your time, Associate Professor of History. Up next, Lasha Chaturia. I'm gonna ask them how to pronounce his last name. But Lasha will be up, and we'll be talking about sort of the political ramifications of this decision of Britain to leave the EU. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome, who's joining us on the phone line, is Lasha Chaturia. Lasha, I'm sorry if I'm butchering that last name. I apologize.
Lasha, it's okay, Mike. You did quite well.
Thank you so much. Lasha is Associate Professor and Director of Graduate Programs in Diplomacy and International Relations at Norwich University. Lasha, let me ask you this question right out of the blocks. Can Europe really be united given the aspect of national politics and nationalistic concerns? Will there always be this tension that separates rather than unites Europe?
Yes, those tensions have always been there, but more recently they have been highlighted by the refugee crisis from the Middle East and Africa, and that has put enormous pressure on politicians in individual states. And unfortunately, the European Union itself, the leadership of the European Union, was not or has not been able to come up with any strategy to deal with this crisis. So that's why voters in many countries have reverted to more nationalistic and more populist ideas and leaders. And the most recent vote in Britain on exiting the European Union is a result of that.
Is immigration driving this, Lasha?
In the UK, it's primarily immigration and free movement of labor. According to European Union laws, many professionals can work in other countries of members of the European Union. That has been a problem, not necessarily in terms of economic development, but it has created some bad impressions among especially more conservative voters, not only in the UK, but in wealthier countries of the European Union that currently host literally millions of guest laborers, professionals from Eastern European members of the European Union.
Anybody that travels in Europe, what they find is that in Southern Europe, there's great resentment about the influence of Germany and to some extent France in the EU. And the feeling in Germany and in France is that they feel they're doing all the work and everybody else is getting the benefit. Is Britain just a harbinger of things to come in terms of the difficulty of keeping this union together?
Well, a British exit, if this exit does happen, and in fact no one yet knows how this exit in what shape and form it will take place, it will be relatively easy then for those countries that do not have their own national currencies. United Kingdom has maintained its British pound, refused to join the common currency, the euro. Other countries that share this common currency, for them, it will be much more difficult to disengage, and economic consequences will be dramatic. Now, in terms of discrepancies in the European Union, there are many among the regions. But the main problem that European Union hasn't been able to overcome, the main hurdle it hasn't been able to overcome, was to develop a common fiscal policy. European Union currently has a common monetary policy in terms of the common currency, the EU, but in terms of taxation, there is no commonality. In fact, many countries try to cheat each other and try to take advantage of each other's weaknesses and strengths.
You sound like you're in a beautiful place. There's birds chirping in the background there, Lasha. I wish I was where you are. It sounds beautiful wherever you are.
Thank you. I'm in central Vermont.
We're speaking with Lasha. Out of respect for Lasha and out of respect for you, I'm not going to try to butcher his last name here. Lasha is a PhD, Associate Professor, Director of Graduate Programs in Diplomacy and International Relations at Norwich University. And we're talking about Britain's decision to exit the EU with a referendum vote last week that surprised many, including the pollsters, who thought this was not going to pass. How does the EU operate, Lasha, without one of its biggest members there?
Well, Britain has always been a reluctant member of the European Union. Eurosceptics have prevailed in British politics from very first years. In 1975, they had the referendum exactly on this topic, whether to remain. At that time, it was a two-year member of the European Union, at that time European Economic Community. And it hasn't joined many of the many of the areas that European Union community promoted since, such as it hasn't joined the immigration common Schengen free travel area, hasn't joined the monetary union. It's not going to be easy to have a United Kingdom outside the European Union and maintain an image of a common European house. That won't be possible. However, in terms of economic transactions, financial transactions, London has been a center, global center of international finance. It will remain so. It houses many of the great insurance companies. It provides services worldwide in terms of service industry, and it will not lose its place in that respect, either in Europe or globally. However, there is this problem that Europeans always had with developing the European Union. They have always advocated developing a common European identity, a political and social identity, and they have not been able to make any headway in terms of that. And with the United Kingdom out of the Union, that will become, future European projects will become much more difficult to implement.
Is that possible, to have a European identity when you have so many years of history behind each of those individual members, whether it's France, Germany, Portugal, Spain, you name it? You know, the history is thousands of years old. How do you have a common identity when you have such an uncommon identity from history and a nationalistic view?
Right. That has always been there, right, in the background of European politics. And actually, European politicians have done very well on overcoming those ancient prejudices and stereotypes, especially during the Cold War, during which they had a common rival in the form of Soviet Union, a lot of common interests. However, more recently, after the end of the Cold War, globalization process, the processes went on their own in terms of the political class. Opinion makers in Europe have not been able to control formation of new identities for new generation of Europeans, as well as addressing through a common foreign policy and common defense policy new threats that have emerged within Europe in terms of terrorism, outside of Europe, civil wars, the refugee crisis. And that has brought a lot of old sentiments back that now, interestingly, it's not the new generation that is beholden mostly to those old ideals and old issues, but it's an older generation that has successfully gone through this a period of unification, but now they are making step back. That's why most of the people who voted for British exit from the Union were elderly, not younger generation of Britons.
Interestingly enough, you bring up Russia, who is, I guess you could say, there's a resurrection going on in Russia in terms of military, and I think from their point of view, trying to exert itself economically as well. Does that pose a problem for Europe, given the exit or the planned exit of the UK?
Well, and with the resurrection of Russia as a great power, if not global, at least in European politics, this 19th century great power politics, European politics, has made a comeback. And what Russians are currently trying to do is to engage in balance of power politics, old-style, pre-First World War-type arrangements with their neighbors. And it is to their advantage that the United Kingdom is exiting the European Union, because if you are engaged in balance of power politics, the last thing you want is to have a unified opponent. It's much easier to deal with them if they are separated and there's some kind of disagreement or confusion between them. And that, of course, includes the United States, which is still the biggest military power in European politics. Now, it's not this British exit obviously will not affect defense arrangements between the Europeans and the United Kingdom, as well as North America, Canada, United States, and Britain, and NATO will remain intact. If you know, in fact, I expect that they will be strengthened by this, because now they are emerging as the most stable, viable, and trusted European institution, transatlantic institution. So there are things for Russians to explore in terms of pursuing their power game in Europe. But at the same time, NATO will receive an additional boost by this decision to exit the EU.
Lasha, I got to take a break, but when we come back, what I want to talk about is what impact all of this has on the United States. We're talking with Lasha, PhD, associate professor. That is his first name. I will attempt towards the end of the program to do his last name again. Lasha, how do you pronounce your last name?
Chanturidze.
I'm gonna blow that if I try it. So, Lasha is associate professor, director of graduate programs in diplomacy and international relations at Norwich University. Very interesting subject. We're talking about the exit of the UK, or the vote to exit the European Union by the UK. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Lasha Chanturidze, who is a PhD and associate professor, director of graduate programs in diplomacy and international relations at Norwich University. Lasha, can we expect to see others attempt to leave the UK, or excuse me, the European Union, or is this sort of a one-off with the UK?
It is likely, and that is cannot be excluded, especially in countries that do not have common currency. Even those that do have the euro as their national currency, at least it's a fair thing to have this question on the referendum. And the public, European public, is more or less well informed on these issues. So unless European Union leadership, and I'm not talking about European Union leadership, the fact is that European Union is ruled primarily by civil servants, by bureaucrats. And that is one of the things that upsets you know, voters, public in many countries, in European countries, because there is no pronounced, no influential executive branch of the European Union. And European Parliament is pretty much is a talk show. European Court has some influence on political decisions and social economic aspects of life, but primarily it's the bureaucracy of the European Union that runs the show. So unless something changes in the European Union, how the union is run, how decisions are made, how they're implemented, and there is more transparency and there is more accountability and there is more feedback back and forth, well, it's quite likely that with difficult times, difficult economic and political uncertainties, those kinds of referenda may take place.
You know, I looked at a recent poll of European countries. and their support of the EU. And I found fascinating, of course, we knew Greece, and there was little support for the EU in Greece. But where I was surprised with was, I think it was in the 60s, if I remember correctly, 60% of France, of citizens of France, don't like the fact that they're in the EU. Is this something to be worried about if you're one of those bureaucrats in Brussels?
Oh, absolutely. That actually indicates that what has been happening last 2 years with the exit of refugees from the Middle East and North African countries and Central Asia. Well, imagine being in France or in any other European country, this refugee crisis. The European Union formally regulates those aspects of the common common immigration and movement of people, and there is nothing from for 2 years. There has been anything decisive or approximately decisive from the European civil service or Brussels in general on this issue. So that would create an impression that there is nothing happening because they can't do anything, or there is nothing that they can think of doing. So the people in those naturally, in those kinds of situations, naturally will try to take control of the situation, try to do something one way or another. So it had to be one of the problems when you have leadership, when you have absence of leadership, is that no one is there to, everyone understands there is a problem, but there is no one to make a decision and no one to rally the people whether and make a policy choice, simply. So that aspect of European governance, the absence of common leadership, remains, and it will continue to be a problem.
What's, in your opinion, what's the biggest misconception Americans have of Europe and the European Union?
Well, I think biggest misconception, not only Americans, but everyone assumes Europeans to be homogeneous, to be the same all over. One thing that distinguishes, say, for the United Kingdom, between, there is one major distinction between the United Kingdom and the rest of the Europe, is the different, drastically different political and legal, especially legal structure. Britain relies on a common law legal system, just like the United States, Canada, Australia, and some other countries, while Europeans have a statutory legal system, sometimes known as Napoleonic law or Roman law, in which case all the laws are written down by politicians, by experts, judges, and or so forth. So the laws are formed, are written down, and enforced accordingly. That, it doesn't sit well with those people who are, you know, historically members of the system that we know as the common law system, legal system. And it provides endless irritation to Britons, who will have to deal with these kinds of, in their opinion, very strange laws that come from Europe, and they don't understand why these laws are in place and don't see logic or either common sense in them. So Europe is very diverse, despite the fact that they managed to coexist together peacefully since the Second World War. There are major regional, national, political, legal differences among the states, and that is not necessarily a bad thing, but it plays out in strange ways if things go wrong.
So, Lasha, what does this all mean for the United States? What impact does this have on us?
The United States will not suffer as a consequence of this, and the process, the exit, if the United, well, it has to be decided first how they are going to exit and what exactly they're exiting, because in terms of trade relations, United States, European countries, United Kingdom are members of the World Trade Organization, and they will remain members. So in terms of trade, in impact will be minimal, if any at all. In terms of finance, the world financial system is free, unregulated financial system, for better or for worse. That's what it is. So that won't change. In terms of defense relations between the United States and Europe and UK, I expect that to be strengthened. More recently, we heard opinions about NATO being outdated and irrelevant, and people endorsing the European Union. And with this decision, it turns out to be that NATO is actually very relevant, and the European Union seems to be in crisis. So defense and political links will strengthen. Both UK leadership and individual leadership of European countries will try to shore up support by the United States, not only the U.S., but also Canada, other allies, Western allies such as Japan, Australia, and that will, in fact, promote more transatlantic transactions, in my opinion, than not. So, overall, the impact for the United States, I don't think there will be any negative impact. The British pound may go down in value, but in fact, that may benefit American tourists going to the UK for vacation.
Lasha, what can we expect in the upcoming weeks? Are we going to see a revote there in Great Britain?
The question that was posed to the British public was very a simple question, leaving the European Union, that everyone understands, but the process everyone understands differently. And now, since we have lots of interest groups and politicians and sides engaged in this debate, they have to figure out first what it means to leave the Union. Does it mean that United Kingdom can choose to exit certain arrangements, such as on immigration and labor, or does it mean that UK will not join any future arrangements, if European arrangements, but will keep the current ones? And if whatever it means, that who is going to negotiate this with whom? Is the UK? Would the UK negotiate this with civil service in Brussels, European political leadership that has no real power, or individual member states of the European Union? These things, no one has the answer on these things. And that what they're trying to figure out now, how this is going to play out. In fact, as we speak, there's going on in Brussels.
Yeah, Lasha, I got to stop. Lasha, I got to stop you there. Unfortunately, it's been fascinating, but we're running out of time. We got about 30 seconds left. So thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Lasha Chantorice, who is an associate professor, director of graduate programs in diplomacy and international relations at Norwich College. Coming up, we'll check in with our friends at Talk Media News, and then Frank Chaffee, president of GBIC. We're talking about the National Guard bringing F-35s. And then Nora Jacobson, filmmaker and winner of the 2016 Herb Lockwood Prize for her documentary efforts out there. So that was coming up, and I thought that was a fascinating fascinating discussion on the exit of the UK from the European Union. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's a great time when I love doing this, checking in with Bob Ney each week, seeing what's happening on the political front. Good morning, Bob.
Mike Smith, Open Mic. How are you?
Great. Thank you. Hey, let me ask you this. Is Trump in trouble?
Well, okay. Let me answer this, I think, in the right way. Technically, yes, but technically no, in the sense that here's what I tell friends. He's made every mistake under the sun. Lewandowski left the campaign. Now he's got another guy. Now he's backtracking on Muslims, on and on and on. Still calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. And after all the shouting's done, and after all the problems, and he's got people, George Will's quitting the Republican Party, people are endorsing Hillary Clinton, still, but if you add all the polls up, he's about 5 points behind. I find that incredible. Technically, again, yes, he's got troubles. But she must be so weak for him to not be, you know, 25 points and you can't breathe.
Yeah, it's the luck of the draw for him. If he had another candidate, that candidate could be opponent. That opponent could be 10 to 15 points up by
right.
now.
Exactly. That's what I think.
It's interesting in that if you look at the disapprovals, he's at 70% disapproval, which is sky high, obviously. But uh-huh. she's at 55%, which isn't any great shakes as well. And I mean, I'm going to talk about Donald Trump in a minute. But, you know, Hillary Clinton has a problem here in that you're absolutely right. I mean, Donald Trump has made all these mistakes, and I'll talk about discipline in a minute. But one of the things that he is starting to lose ground to her, but a major concern of their campaign must be the 55% disapproval rating and the fact that people don't trust her.
If I was running the Clinton campaign, I would be seriously alarmed right now that we can't kind of put Donald Trump away in the sense that, you know, he's done, he's said his last outrageous thing or, you know, whatever. And it's just, she's stuck. She's sort of out there and stuck. So I think that this vast amount of citizenry out there are going to look at, for the first time, a vice presidential pick, for the first time in America's history, probably counting, the debate in emotion. And they're going to make a decision. And I still argue it's going to be close. So therefore, one or two points either way will flip one of them into the White House.
What I find confusing, Bob, is that it seems like Donald Trump is squandering precious time in his campaign. I mean, time he needs to define himself, time that he needs to define his opponent, to coalesce the Republican coalition, to appeal to independents, raise money, which, you know, hasn't. And as you know, raising money just doesn't mean for him. It's for the field operations for other people in other states. And right now, his opponents are having a field day defining him as a bigot, a racist, a sexist. Does he need to bring more discipline into his campaign?
I think so, because, look, once the primary ended, once he finished Ted Cruz, right, at that point in time, he should have pivoted, and that's it. You're focused. Don't go picking a fight with the governor of New Mexico because she doesn't come to your event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't go doing those things that he's done. I mean, he just can't help himself sometimes. And he just keeps, you know, going at it. Now, I know that made him successful at one point in time, I guess. But, you know, I think he does squander a lot of time. He wasted an entire 8 days on that judge, on his civil case.
Yeah, on the judge, on Susana Martinez, even on the Orlando nightclub. I mean, the NRA kind of backed away from him and where he was going on that. And I guess the question that I have is that wouldn't it be – I'm not sure that conservatives trust him, and that's, you know, one of the things that I wanted to sort of get your read on that. Conservatives, they don't trust him, and wouldn't it sort of help him to sort of – set out and articulate a consistent set of core values or beliefs?
Well, yesterday, with the Supreme Court case basically saying that Texas, you know, abortion law to restrict abortions, which is what it was, you know, not constitutional, Donald Trump did not come out and make a statement. Hillary Clinton said this is great for abortion rights. He didn't make a statement, a pro-life statement. Now, he called the evangelicals and said, hey, I'm going to appoint pro-life justices. But he didn't make a statement. And so conservatives, who, by the way, many are very angry that he beat Ted Cruz, and they won't forgive him for it, and they go on their Facebook accounts and they batter him every hour. They really do. And friends of mine do. And then other people say, okay, then you want Hillary Clinton. Well, no, I don't. So the conservatives are out there, and they dislike him so much and mistrust him so much, they won't give him a break. I mean, they're actually bad-mouthing him all the time. So what do they want? Do they want Hillary? Now, I think they might come around, but guess what? It might be too late.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think the next 2 weeks he better lock down the base. I mean, my goodness, if you can't lock down the base, what are you doing?
That's right. And if you walk into the convention, that leads to my next question, Bob. If you walk into the convention without the base locked down, aren't you just begging for problems into the general election?
Well, yes. Look, I'm going to be at the convention in Cleveland. Governor Kasich is the governor of Ohio now. I think that Governor Kasich made a pledge he'd support the nominee, and he's not doing that, and I think that's not right. But having said that, Donald Trump has said, well, he's not going to speak at the convention unless he endorses me. Now, does Trump actually want to – if I were Trump, I'd be like, okay, he doesn't endorse me, fine. I'm, you know, go speak at the convention. Can Kasich actually stand at that convention and badmouth Donald Trump and not get booed off that stage? No, he can't. But Trump's just got to lay another, you know, another poker chip out there. Kasich, you're not speaking at the convention, and Cruz, you aren't until you endorse me. You know? Yeah, it just, he's got to, you know, some things, you know, you can't win them all, and you have to let nature take its course.
Isn't it time to get professionals in there to take control of this campaign? I mean, it.
Well, yeah, I don't know that they can. I mean, Corey Lewandowski, you know, who was fired by Trump, said, you know, let Trump be Trump. I'm not so sure that Corey could let him be anything else than what he was, you know, wanted to be. I'm not so sure the new guys can do anything particular. But they've got to convince him, you know, look, you have a chance to be president of the United States. Now, do you want to, you don't have to change all your views, but do you want to kind of at least play, you know, some of the game a little bit and not attack everybody?
Hey, Bob, as always, I enjoy our conversations.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you so much. You. That's Bob Nay from Talk Media News. Up next, Frank Chaffee, president of GBIC. We're going to be talking about F-35s. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have on the line joining us this morning is Frank Chaffee, of president of the Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation. And the topic we're going to discuss today is the National Guard's decision to bring in the F-35s. And it has been a controversial decision, both in Winooski and South Burlington. Good morning, Frank. How are you?
Great, Mike. Thanks for having me on today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Hey, Frank, why do you support bringing in the F-35s?
Pretty plain and simple. First of all, GBIC, Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation, is one of the state's 12 not-for-profit regional economic development corporations. So the way we do land use planning and economic development support in Vermont is we have a central agency of commerce and community development in Montpelier. And then working with that agency of commerce and community development, we have 12 regional nonprofit land use planning commissions that help municipalities do land use planning and transportation planning. And we have 12 nonprofit regional economic development corporations that really focus on helping the municipalities focus on keeping high wage jobs in Vermont and working with employers that have the profiles of being dollar importing, goods and services exporting. So they tend to be the employers that bring dollar one into the state of Vermont's economy, and they hire Vermonters at a higher wage. So traditionally it's been manufacturing, technology, and now in the changing global economics, it's changing into value-added services as well as the manufacturing base. So our whole motivation is the retention of this economic investment here in Vermont for several reasons. One, there's 1,100 jobs associated with the Vermont Air Guard in Vermont, and the mission for the Vermont Air Guard is they're a fighter wing, and they've had fighter planes here for decades. The F-35 is a successor plane to the F-16s that we have here now. And other economic facts are that we without the Vermont Air Guard, we would not have the quality of the airport that we have here in Burlington. They're locating here has been kind of a magnet for federal support for the kinds of systems that are in place and the infrastructure that's in place that we have, you know, the high-quality runways that we have here. They also supply the emergency services and the fire services for the airport, so that the airport does not pay for any of the fire or rescue services at the airport. So, you know, if you're looking at the capital facilities there, that's probably a $25 or $30 million capital investment to house the fire and rescue services, and then an operational cost of maybe around $2.5 million a year that the airport does not have to bear that the Air Guard does this for the airport. So strictly from an economic basis, this is a very, very serious issue about the retention of really high-wage jobs. The Guard, the overall Guard has about 5,500 in the Army Guard and about 1,100 in the Air Guard here. So from an economic standpoint, it's the retention of these 1,100 jobs. I know some of the opponents have said that if we did not get this plane, that we would still have an Air Guard. Well, that's true. We would still have an Air Guard because every state has to have an Air Guard. But an Air Guard without a mission, which in our estimation, we would end up with a fraction of what we have here without it. And then from a reality standpoint, the F-35 is a successor plane, and the life of the F-16 has been 40 years. So we're really looking at this basing of the F-35 as securing the future of the Air Guard for decades to come by getting this plane here.
And of course, Frank, the city of Winooski has sued for a new impact study, I believe, and now South Burlington. And the reason I've got you on the phone is because this has been in the news lately. South Burlington has voted to join the suit, I think, as an amicus brief. What's the opposition?
An amicus brief is a friend of the court brief, so it's not a full opposition. And I might say that this isn't the city. It's the city of South Burlington operating on a 3-2 vote. They have a 5-person city council, and there was a political composition change in the council. So opponents of the F-35 have taken control of the council. So they decided that they would take a new vote on whether or not to support. Well, not whether or not to support the F-35, because they say they're not against it. They say the position of South Burlington is not against it, but they're raising concerns at this point in the permitting process. So just from a legal standpoint, South Burlington, like every other municipality in our region, like every citizen in the region, had the opportunity to file in the permit process and to register their opinions, their concerns throughout the permitting process. And this permitting process is called the EIS, Environmental Impact Statement. South Burlington's already registered their concerns and opinions, as well as Burlington and Winooski registered theirs. And they missed the window of filing for legal action. And this move is, first of all, it's political in nature. The opponents to stop the F-35 coalition group is the one that encouraged the three members of the South Burlington City Council to vote in favor of this intervention to do what they're doing. And any of us that are very aware of the permitting process in Vermont and how opponents use the permitting process and try to delay things, this is a legal delay tactic, is what it is. It's being motivated by the Stop the F-35 coalition. So South Burlington missed the window to file for anything, to file as an opponent, to file as an amicus brief. So first they have to ask the court if they can enter an appearance. There was a hearing scheduled for July 5th. What they're trying to do is delay that hearing and by filing for an appearance. Maybe the judge will allow them a hearing. Maybe the judge will allow them to file an amicus status. An amicus status means they're supposed to also bring up something that's new, that hasn't been raised, and they're bringing up the composite materials that are in the composition of the F-35, the same materials that exist in all the planes that fly in and out of the airport here in Vermont. So anyway, this is a legal delay tactic on the part of the Stop the F-35 coalition.
Let me ask this question, just from your perspective: is it a noise issue with the F-35s? Is it a composition issue of what the aircraft is made up of? Is it a F-35 production issue, or is it just opposition to those that don't want a military mission at the airport? Is it a combination of all those, or is there one particular issue that has upset people?
When Vermont was competing for this basing, well, first of all, the Air Force has already made their decision that we have been selected for basing, and basing will occur in 2019. The environmental impact statement process was completed. This challenge by the Stop the F-35 coalition was issued. So they have a full challenge in to the environmental impact statement process. They convinced Winooski there was a political change in Winooski on the board, and Winooski, the city council in Winooski asked for a referendum in Winooski. It narrowly passed. The referendum in Winooski passed. And then they decided they would enter an amicus status on some very limited areas. So Winooski is expressing their concerns by amicus brief in some very, very limited areas. South Burlington missed this window. South Burlington wanted to appeal. They should have appealed during that time period. So they're after the fact now appealing. So what the motivation is, I'll go back to the first hearing. In the first hearing, after the announcement that Vermont was competing for this award, there's a group of some very passionate, good Vermonters who are just anti-war, anti-defense, and they organized an opposition. Their message wasn't selling, so they then came up with the issue of noise, and that wasn't selling because the noise is, you know, fighter jets are not quiet, and the exposure to them is about 6 minutes a day, 4 to 5 days a week, is what the actual experience is. The noise is very similar to from an F-35 to an F-16. That wasn't selling. So then they went on health, and they were saying that the noise is going to affect children in the area, and then that didn't sell. So then they switched to everyone's home around the airport was going to be uninhabitable, and the price values were going to go through the cellar. And that didn't sell, so then they switched it up to composite materials and everything. They're trying to come up with anything that they can to delay this, to delay the permitting process and delay the process, which is a tactic that opponents always use in Vermont. And I'll kind of, you know, give you an example of the CERC highway. This is how the opponents of the CERC highway dragged the CERC highway out, that they kept filing opposition along the way. So this group has already filed in the Vermont permit process, and they filed at the district environmental level, and they were denied there. They filed at the environmental court level. They were denied there. They filed at the Vermont Supreme Court, and they were denied there. They then filed at the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't think anything happened with that. And now they're filing in the federal process, which is environmental impact statement process. So they're using every little step along the way to try to delay.
So this is in the federal court, Frank, and we're speaking with Frank Chaffee, the president of GBIC, the Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation. We're talking about the National Guard decision to bring the F-35s here to Burlington, the National Guard's decision to do that. So we're in federal district court. When is the court case actually heard?
Well, there's supposed to be a hearing on July 5th. I don't know if that's going to occur or not. I think South Burlington, the meeting in South Burlington was late last week, so they're trying to hustle to file a motion now for an appearance, and I don't know if they'll try to parallel that with actually writing the amicus brief, but they missed the opportunity to file, so they have to ask the court for permission to file anything. So that has to happen first, and then they'll, if the judge deems that they're bringing up something new, or the judge just wants to give them the opportunity to file an amicus status, the judge can do that. That's up to the judge's prerogative as to whether or not the judge wants to do this at all. And if they do, then and the judge decides to let them file, then they have to write an amicus brief. And the amicus brief is going to have to be pretty narrow and targeted towards the issues that they've raised. So GBIC did file an amicus brief in support of the United States Air Force and the federal government. And our areas were strictly on economics and the economic impact of the airport and what this investment means to our region and to our state.
Frank, I got to take a short break, but when I come back, I want to talk about the reasons why people should support the F-35s from your perspective. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Frank Chaffee, the president of the Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation. What we're talking about is the National Guard's decision to base the F-35s here in Burlington, Vermont, and also the opposition to basing those F-35s here. Frank, the Air Force selected Vermont for the F-35s, and that didn't have to happen. Why did the Air Force select Vermont and the Air National Guard for the F-35s?
Well, probably for a lot of reasons. First, the level of experience and proficiency of the pilot team that's here and the fighter wing that's here in Vermont is really second to none in the United States. The Air Force decided that they were going to select a full-time Air Force base and a National Guard base in this country. So there were many bases throughout the country and many National Guard installations that were competing for it. They narrowed it down to six, and then Vermont was one of the six, and Vermont became the selected base for the Air National Guard base, and the U.S. Air Force base is Hill Air Force Base in Utah that was selected as well. So the first planes came to Utah last spring, and Vermont is scheduled for our planes to occur for basing here in 2019. So the other reasons that they did this here is the strategic location of the Vermont National Guard base to training. So most of the training goes on in the Adirondack Parkway, in the wilderness area in upstate New York, where there are no people, and basically it's a climate similar to that of Afghanistan and other areas around the world. So there's a lot of training that goes on there. The other thing is that we have a simulated flight training center here in Burlington at the Air National Guard base, where every F-16 pilot in the country comes in to basically get recertified and do simulation training. We're hoping that will end up be replaced as an F-35 simulation center in the future as well. So number one, it's because of the experience and the expertise of the fighter wing here in Vermont. Number two is that our geographic and climate played a great role. Probably the third reason is, since the war on terror, the whole basic composition and structure of how we defend our country is now in a combination of basically activating National Guards throughout the United States, both the Army Guard and the Air Guards. And these men and women play a very active role in the defense of our country. And, as well as most Vermonters know, that the Army Guard and the Air Guard have been deployed several times in Iraq and Afghanistan and the current war on terror in different missions.
Let me ask you this. There is a belief, I think, if I'm reading the newspapers correctly, among some that the Air Force is lying or spreading misinformation. How do you respond to that?
I think it's fabrication on the part of the opponents that, you know, they're reaching for. The Air Force isn't going to lie about anything. That the facts are there. The Air Force has done an excellent job in preventing in really presenting all of the environmental impacts, the economic impacts, the health impacts, the benefits of this basing, what this basing means. It is the responsibility of the Air Force to lay out everything in the environmental impact statement, and it's about 1,100 page document. They take these applications very seriously, and we think that they've done a darn good job in terms of their filings.
Frank, what sort of political support do you have for the F-35s in this state?
Huge political support. The opposition is really a smaller group of Vermonters. They're very passionate, and I personally respect these people. They're good Vermonters. They just have a contrary opinion about this basing, and they're tenacious. But there's overwhelming support for the National Guard in Vermont and for the Army Guard and the Air Guard. We did some outreach. The Green Ribbons campaign grew as a grassroots effort to support the men and women of the Air Guard and the Army Guard. And they generated about 22,000 names on petitions, just putting them at gas stations in 2 weekends about a year and a half ago. The grassroots support for the Guard is huge. And I think the average Vermonter, isn't prone to jump up and, wave a flag in favor of something or against something. They just go about their business and tend to their families and mind their own business. But we know that there's overwhelming support for the Guard.
Where's our federal delegation on this issue?
Federal delegation is 100% in support of this basing. Senator Leahy has supported it from day one. Senator Sanders has supported it from day one. Congressman Welch has supported it. The governor has supported it. Lieutenant governor supported it. So there's pretty universal support. It's funny to me that a bunch of the some of the people in the Stop the F-35 coalition were very critical of Senator Sanders' support for this when he was running for re-election. And then I looked at the Free Press website when Bernie came home 2 weeks ago, and there is one of the lead opponents to this who had been critical of Senator Sanders standing there welcoming Bernie back to Burlington on his presidential campaign. So Senator Sanders, I don't think that this was a natural thing for him to support, but he has been an ardent supporter of the men and women of the Vermont National Guard, and his position was that he was not wild about the defense budget, but if this was going to pass as part of the defense budget, that and there was going to be a basing at a National Guard base somewhere in the country, then he wanted to be here. And that's, it's true to form for Bernie. He is he's honest and very passionate about what he does, what he supports, and he's not afraid to take a stand. Senator Leahy has been really the leader for our entire congressional delegation for his support for the men and women of the Vermont National Guard in so many ways, from the Black Hawk helicopters that are here, for our Army Guard, and for everything that's occurred over the years for the Vermont Air National Guard. We've got a great delegation, Congressman Welch as well. These three work together very well to make sure that the men and women of the National Guard have the best equipment and facilities that they could possibly have.
Hey, Frank, thank you very much for your time. And that's Frank Chaffee, for the president of GBIC, Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation. Thank you, Frank.
Okay, Mike, have a great day.
Same to you. Same to you.
Bye-bye.
Frank Chaffee, president of the GBIC. GIC, Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation, talking about the National Guard's decision to base the F-35s in Burlington. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Just a reminder, today's poll question, did the American media do a good job informing you about the ramifications of Bredix prior to the vote? Go on to our WDEV Facebook page and cast your vote. It's my pleasure now to welcome filmmaker Nora Jacobson and winner of the 2016 Herb Lockwood Prize. Good morning, Nora.
Good morning, Mike.
Nora, I am always fascinated how people wind up in the profession that they ultimately find themselves in. How did you become a filmmaker?
Oh, I've been a filmmaker all my life. I started in high school making little Super 8 films as a way to get out of writing English papers, although now I actually quite enjoy writing, but back then I didn't so much, and so I found that filmmaking was just beginning to be something that regular people could think about doing, because before that it was all Hollywood. But in the 60s and late 60s, it started to be more accessible. And so with this little Super 8 camera, I started making movies, and then I continued in college a bit, and then continued in graduate school, and then all my, you know, ever since after that.
You recently won the 2016 Herb Lockwood Prize, which is meant to recognize your artistic excellence and community outreach. Were you surprised?
I was extremely surprised. I got this phone call from Todd Lockwood, Herb's brother, older brother, and left a message saying, call me back. I have some good news for you. And I had no idea what he was referring to. I knew a little bit. I'd met him, I think, once, Todd, but I didn't know why he was calling me. But, of course, good news. I was happy to call him back. And then he told me, and I was just overwhelmed and thrilled and touched and moved by it, because I know that there are so many Vermont artists who are amazing artists and also do community work as well. So it was a special recognition for me, and I was just very aware of the fact that as happy as I was to get it, I also was thinking about all the other artists who didn't get it this year but might next year. So that's good.
I'm fascinated when I was looking at your body of work. You have it's amazing what you sort of select. For example, your film includes a documentary that talks delivered vacant gentrification of Hoboken, New Jersey. And then you go to a dramatic film, which is My Mother's Early Lovers. How do you select these subjects?
Yeah, it's interesting. People have commented on how eclectic my work is, and it's true that I almost never do the same thing twice, which has its good sides and its bad sides. You know, if the bad sides are that you never get quite as good doing one thing as you might if you kept, you know, doing it again. But for me, the process is so fun and exciting, filmmaking in general, that I'm always trying new things. So my topics really almost grow out of each other, because My Mother's Early Lovers, I had came out of this exhaustion from working on this documentary, Delivered Vacant. I had spent 8 years working on that film in Hoboken, New Jersey, and was exhausted by trying to make people, real people, voices come into a coherent narrative. And a friend from Vermont had written a memoir about her family, and not only was I interested in the topic, because it had to do with community, intentional community living, whereas Hoboken was about not an intentional community, but definitely a community. And then it was a narrative piece. I knew I could work with actors, and I'd never worked with actors before. and it was time also to move back to Vermont for me. So there was a reason that my mother's early lovers came after Delivered Vacant.
Hmm.
And it was a sort of a natural path for me.
Which do you like doing more, documentaries or drama, or is that a Sophie's choice?
I like both. I love real stories, first of all, and all of my narrative fictional films have some basis in real life. I do a lot of research. I find story bits of people whose lives interest me, and I weave them into narrative fictional films. So I like both, and I feel that there's quite a similarity between interviewing someone and making them feel comfortable so that they shine and their words are really evocative. And directing an actor, where as a director, you're trying to get the best out of them. And so it doesn't seem so different to me.
I mean, when you think of Vermont, you don't normally think of filmmaking. Are there challenges being a filmmaker in Vermont?
Well, one challenge is that you're not surrounded by the business of filmmaking. And so trying to get a film made is a challenge because there's not a lot of funding. And, you know, the Herb Lockwood Award is the biggest award, you know. I mean, it's not just for films, by the way. I mean, I was lucky to get it for film, but there's not a lot of money for the arts really in Vermont, which is surprising because Vermont does have its prosperous pockets, and I've been very lucky to raise money in Vermont, but it's hard to get your film seen. It's hard to get recognition outside of Vermont, you know. So, and if you spend a lot of time working in Vermont, you go to New York or you go to LA and you're a beginner, you're a neophyte, you know, no one knows who you are. And it's very hard to maintain some kind of professional visibility in the centers of film, which are New York and L.A., if you're living in Vermont. So it's a fantastic place to work, not a great place to get professional recognition, I would say.
I'm always fascinated with people and what they do. What keeps you passionate about what you do?
For me, it's the process. I just love every aspect of filmmaking, from the writing, you know, even in documentaries, I write out questions. I write out an outline that helps me. I love writing screenplays. It's a really fun kind of writing that's all about visuals, writing images, and I find that an interesting challenge. And then the filming part, framing a shot. I like shooting a lot. I don't always shoot my films myself, but I do love shooting. And the excitement of that is wonderful. And the editing perhaps is my forte, I would say, in the sense that I really love sitting for hours and hours and hours in front of the computer editing and putting sound together. I love adding music to a film, to stories. And so the only part that I find challenging is the distribution part, getting the film out there, because once I've finished the film, I already have one or two new projects in the works that I want to get started on. And really, distribution takes a tremendous amount of time and work, and I have to start doing that seriously for my new film. But at the same time, I'm trying to get funding and get back to work on two other projects that are in the works. So distribution is difficult, and of course fundraising is always difficult. The work part I love.
You hit the word right on the right word, which is eclectic. I'm looking at your work here: Delivered Vacant, My Mother's Early Lovers, Nothing Like a Dream, Habits and Choices, Freedom and Unity, the Vermont movie. What are you going to be working on next?
Well, I am working right now. I'm trying to get a new film distributed, which is a fictionalized film based on a memoir that a friend of mine wrote about international adoption of a Korean girl and her American mother and their challenges. That interests me a great deal. And so that's a film I'm trying to get out. The film is pretty much done. I'm also working on a documentary about Ruth Stone, one of Vermont's poet laureates, a wonderful, wonderful poet that not that many non-poets know about. So I'm hoping that this film about her and her life will make more people know her work. And then I'm also working with Rob Coyer, a filmmaker friend from the Vermont movie, on a series called North Star, probably a TV series, about the stories of people of color, Native Americans, mixed race, and whites in the 100 years right before the Civil War, through it and afterwards. So we're seeing this as a kind of a 10-part series about people of color in New England and, of course, in Vermont. So those are big projects, and I'm excited about them.
And, Nora, if people wanted to find out more about your films, where would they go?
They would go to my website, offthegridproductions.com. That tells a little bit about all of my films. If they want to know about the Korean adoption film, that's thehanjiboxmovie.com. The Vermont movie, if they want to know about the Vermont movie, we have a website called thevermontmovie.com. And as perhaps people know, that is a massive 6-part collaborative series that I made with over 50 other Vermont filmmakers. And we have a website, and we have, a trailer. So I have about 3 websites that people can find out more from.
Nora, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. It's been a pleasure for me.
Nora Jacobson, the filmmaker and winner of the 2016 Herb Lockwood Prize, and she has a lot of films on. Visit her website. I want to thank our guests today, Stephen Sutterjohn from the Associate Professor of History at Norwich University. Our topic was Britain's exit of the EU, and then Lasha Chantarija, who is also an Associate Professor. He's the Director of Graduate Programs in Diplomacy at International Relations at Norwich College. And again, we were talking about the UK's decision to leave the EU, and I apologize to Lasha on many occasions in getting his last name wrong and trying to get it right. We also spoke with Frank Chaffee, president of GBIC, the Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation, and talked about the National Guard's decision to cite the F-35s and the opposition to those F-35s in Burlington at Burlington Airport. And of course, we just spoke with Nora Jacobson, filmmaker and winner of the 2016 Herb Lockwood Prize. And she has many films out there. Visit her website. Fascinating, fascinating films that she has. This is Open Mic. You are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550 broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you all for your phone call.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.